Greetings and salutations, everyone out there. This is AC2GS. My name is Roy, and I'm the control operator for this, the Limar Technical Net. Limar Technical Net has been going on since 1982, and it persists every Sunday night at 8 p.m. until a little bit around 11 o'clock. We usually run 5, 10, 15 minutes over that. And everyone is welcome, as always. Let me drop in. I'll give you the usual link pages, such. Okay, as always, if you have any questions, if you have any topics you would like to hear covered, if you would like to share puzzles, if you would like to comment on any aspect of this technical net, or if you would like to be the tap for a pool, WS2N on the shoulder, and have them take a look at some space report and comment, the email address to reach us continues to be mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. Link pages are available. I have a whole bunch of things on my link page for tonight alone. There's a very interesting YouTube of Professor Wolf Lewin's a seeming discovery of a perpetual motion machine. There's a link to some newly uploaded Ham Radio University 2021 YouTube. There's our own Mark WA2MAV's MATLAB plots of lossless and lossy transmission lines. Some stuff that Paul is going to talk about later. An FCC notification that came out recently advising us not to break the law. And some other things, some topics that we might cover or might not cover, and if we don't, you can at least hit the links later on and read them in the privacy of your own establishment. Let me drop for a second, and I'll give you our schedule for tonight. Okey-doke. We will start by asking people if they have any questions or topics. We will take their first name and their call sign and put them on our little list and try and get to them in a timely manner. Somewhere between 8:30 and 8:45, we will summon Andy, WA2CDL, from Andy's Corner to give us another great presentation of his. And I look forward to that. When he's done, I will return. And we'll wrap up any other questions that remain, either on our list or people thought up, or topics or comments or questions that come up later on. At around 10:15 or so, give or take 15 minutes, Paul will come on and give you the SpaceNet report, and that'll take us around 11 o'clock p.m., where we'll wish you all well, and shut her down until the next week. So that's the plan for tonight. I hope we get to all those pieces, and I hope they entertain and inform you. This is AC2GS. Please, if you have any questions or topics tonight, give me your first name and your call sign.
Good evening, Roy. This is Ken, WB2KWC, with a question.
KCTJC, one call with a question.
Answer me, please. Again, Ken, WB2KWC, I recognize you. I wrote you down. The other gentleman, I couldn't quite write all that down. So if you could just give me that information one more time, please.
KG2RY, David.
Okay, David recognized I heard someone out there about 16 decibels below normal audio. So check your audio feed, check your microphone, and try again, please.
WA2MAV, on.
KCTJC, JC.
Okay. Okay, very good. We have Mark, we have Ken, we have Mark, we have David, and we have JC. Anyone else want to put their name on the list for tonight? Okay, that should keep us busy for a while. First up is Ken, WB2KWC. What's your question or your topic tonight, Ken?
Okay, thank you, Roy. It's about problems I've been having with a Bluetooth headset. I've got an inexpensive Bluetooth headset that I pair with my phone, and when I go out walking, I listen to podcasts. Lately, it seems whenever I walk out of the house, it needs to be repaired with the phone, and I'm trying to figure out why. You know, is it some silly thing that I have done, or basically is it just getting old? And 3 years is about the lifetime for a $20 Bluetooth headset.
Well, if I was a betting man, I would bet that its time has come. I mean, I've even had problems with Apple's AirPods, where they've lost my pairing. I blamed it on upgrading the operating system, so I would set it to get that Bluetooth pair and reset the Bluetooth device and then repair it. But I've noticed that it also tends to lose one of the two earpieces. It'll turn into a mono device. So I would assume most likely that it's the actual Bluetooth. And the only thing you can really do other than buy a new one is to look in the instructions and reset it entirely as best you can and repair it. If it keeps dropping out, then I would seriously consider kind of looking through the internet for a good price for a good quality new Bluetooth. These things come and go. I mean, they're already up to Bluetooth 5.0, and it has a few more bells and whistles. It has a little bit better range. It has a little bit better bit rate and such, so it might pay to upgrade. But that would be my suggestion. I'd be interested in other people's ideas. So basically, it comes down to a full system restore, a factory setting, and repairing, and looking for sales as time goes on for a new one.
Okay, that's what I was doing. I've been looking around, and one of these days I will see one, because it gets annoying. And what's weird is that it works fine in the house. And the moment I leave the house, it starts beeping at me and telling me I've lost my connection. It's almost as if as soon as I get out of Wi-Fi range, my Bluetooth stops working, which I'm not sure that there's any logic in there other than that the frequencies are near each other, but you would think that if it was interaction with Wi-Fi, it would be just the opposite. And when I got into the house, it would lose its pairing.
Yeah, I would agree. It makes very little sense to me unless there's something a little wonky with the cell phone, so that when it drops the Wi-Fi, it's in settling into a non-Wi-Fi connected mode or in search of another Wi-Fi site, it screws up its Bluetooth system, which should be a separate circuit. It's almost the same frequency, but it's a different circuit, and they shouldn't really interfere with each other. So it could be a little wonkiness on the part of the cell phone. It could be that your environment beyond your house have some kind of a strong 2.4 megahertz signal that disrupts things. Some guy who likes the microwave a lot with a leaky microwave or something else like that. Yes, Lou.
What is that? And after you leave your premises and you're a little bit away from it and you reset it, repair it.
Okay, just as a side note, Lou, your signal is very noisy. It's about 70% noise, and towards the end, it was kind of cutting out at times.
All right, did you copy what I said?
I did. Did Ken copy?
No, not completely.
All right, let me jump in again. Yeah, Ken, I said my suggestion was as you leave your house and you walk for a while and you're away from your house, repair it and, you know, use it and then slowly approach your house again and see if it again tries to disconnect or give you an issue as you're approaching your house. And that might validate some interference source just outside of the perimeter of your home.
Okay, you've given me two ideas. I guess the first idea is to turn off the Wi-Fi while I'm still in the house, see if that makes a difference. And then the second one is after I repair it, I guess come back to the house and see if that affects the connection at all.
Let me add this little variation also. If it's possible for you to turn off the access point itself, that would probably be a little bit of a better of an experiment, because what you would really like to do is simulate your cell phone searching for another wireless access point. Whereas if you turn off the wireless function of the cell phone, it's not going to go searching. So it might not be a completely valid experiment under those circumstances.
Okay, that's interesting. To basically kill the Wi-Fi. I guess talk to my wife about it so that suddenly I'm not killing the Wi-Fi connection to her devices.
I've gone to sleep, so don't really need mitigate the damage. Stuff that people like us have to do to maintain our system, and the rest of the family is kind of like, I want to watch Netflix type of activity.
My wife is quite reasonable. She spends a large amount of time watching television. I will just find a time where she is not actively engaged in watching it on YouTube and casting it to the TV through the Chromecast, and I'll turn it off then. Or I'll just wait till she goes to bed.
Okay, very good. Good luck, and please come back and tell us how the experiments work.
Okay, I will do that. I will give you a report. Okay, I will. I've got homework. KC2GS, W2KWC.
Okay, very good. Anyone else with contact before I move on to the next person? Okay, on to the next. WA2MAV. He sent me some very interesting MATLAB simulation. I've put it on the link page, roy.ac2gs.com, so you can take a look at them. I think MPGs, I tweaked them into animated GIFs so you can see the curves traveling. It's very interesting. The labels need to be a little bit, but otherwise very fascinating. So, Mark. You wanted to discuss, I assume you wanted to discuss these illustrations.
Yes, yes, right. Thanks for posting them up there. Yeah, I can discuss them if people want to get more information on them. your speaker should have the power flow. You know about him. Mm-hmm. Called the Chasic OIK. There's a whole bunch of pages on antennas, electromagnetic, for physics, and the sort of the model of antennas, too. And he did cover this one area which I was trying to validate. He was saying this is an added loss due to VSWR. Now my model does give the right answer to the formulas that were given in the ORL handbook, and there were some other guys on the internet had different forms, and I was able to take the equations and get those. But the Chasic OIK pointed out that you can't really ignore the intelligence is really complex. Equations fall apart for very high VSWR. So I modified my program to accept the complex characteristic impedance. And I got results that came close to what he had in his case. So I'm going to sort that out a little bit. But those power flow plots were pretty interesting to look at also. That's probably what matters the most. Transmitting into a coax, and the power flows in. And I also plot the instantaneous power. And there is negative power, which shouldn't be a surprise. Robert, that would be. If you have a mismatch on one end, no power is going to go out, and then the energy is stored in the transmission line. And on some cycles, it would be flowing back towards the transmitter. So you can actually see that on the plot. I'm going to send away the plot. And then you can see that since it's a lossy line, you can see the power flow into the transmission line. You can also see, how the reflections die out on the other direction. You can see that with those plots we had up there also. So hopefully I'll resolve all the little issues with that, and then I'll have a nice model, and I'll have to clean up the plots. There's a couple of wrong titles on it, but we'll like to sound those. But that's what happens when you make it. It's really easy to find everything. So that's, if you really want a good presentation on the loss, extra loss of VSWR, I would sign a Chasic OIK website articles up there. I sort of like a link from a link, and I'm glad I ran into it. I think you know everything about a topic until you find the guy that did way more work than you did. If anybody has any questions, I'll answer them. Just wait till I make it.
Okay, very good, Mark. Yeah, I mean, the technology, as I've often said, is like an onion. With multiple skins, and you could just keep going down further and further, and ultimately there are guys who will give you a quantum electrodynamic explanation for things that'll give us all a nosebleed. If anyone has taken a look at the diagrams at roy.ac2gs.com and wants to ask Mark any questions about them, please hit the push to talk button. Okay, nothing more. Some people did smoke to at it and Hopefully you'll be back next Sunday night, and if there are any questions out there, you can handle that. How's that?
That's fine.
Okay, very good. Thanks, Mark, for the illustrations. They look very nice. How losses are seen through the transmission line. So it's you know, one picture's worth a thousand words, if you will. So I look forward to the future images that you'll be generating for us. And take a look at people that I've lost track of every last one of them. So I might have found his website in years earlier, but I'll look again. But thank you very much, Mark. Next on my list tonight, David, KG2RY. David, do you have any particular question or topic tonight?
Good evening, Roy. Good evening, everyone. Intel i5, i7, and i9 processors in a computer. And the other question is, out of all the phones, which one would you recommend if you had a...
Okay, I don't know what's going on with the repeater. There seems to be a lot of noise on it tonight, and people's... transmissions are being noise. I don't know. Let me pause for a second in case someone knows exactly what might be causing this.
K2GJE.
Yes, Ed.
It's very windy out where I live, near Lake Ronkonkoma. I guess on the top of that building, it's really windy. It must be doing a job on the antenna, over.
Okay, it's as good a reason as any. There have been problems with wind conditions and their effects on our repeater, and hopefully that will eventually be fixed. I understand there is talk of changing antennas and such, so maybe that'll help. We'll hope for the best, and we'll try and muddle through. David asked an interesting question. I'm sure Ken has some thoughts on the subject as well. It sort of depends upon what you want to do with your computer. If you want, you know, nothing special, not too many tabs, not too many multitasking, you can, it's an inexpensive a family of Intel chips, i5, a little bit better. I used to be a kind of an i7 guy. I kind of went for the biggest metal I could. Mission control computer that you see on my QRZ page is powered by an i9. The difference, obviously, between an i7 and i9 is you get more cores, so you can benefit from multitasking, multi-threaded software. So I could have a ridiculous number of tabs active on web browsers and applications running as long as they don't really impact my graphic card. Whereas it's way too much overkill, say, for a laptop. Laptops don't even come in i9 chips as far as I'm aware. So, again, it depends upon what you want. If money is no object and you're still Intel, because AMD is coming up with some very cost-effective chips. You know, they used to be kind of, you know, if you needed to cut costs and such, you went AMD. Now you can probably get the same CPU power for roughly the same price, if not a little bit less, with a little bit better power profiles than AMD. It's subject to change every day, but that's the way it seems to me. So generally speaking, most people could get through with an i5 chip. If you need to have the best, fastest, whatever, and still Intel, it would be i7. But I'd be interested in Ken's opinion on this as well.
Okay, very good, Roy. My opinion concurs with yours. As a matter of fact, I just replaced my laptop at the beginning of this year, and basically I kind of tuned it to what I do. You need to consider, I guess, process, battery life. If you're concerned about battery life, maybe not such a fast processor. My previous laptop was an i7. I actually went back to an i5 because I discovered that using my wife's laptop, and the i5 was really quite good. I kind of memory I wanted. I got gigabytes. I could kind of down the graphics, and basically I could around. What I'm going to use that. So what I did, I happened to let you configure. Other manufacturers, you kind of have to go, well, you've got this configuration or that configuration. There's not quite as much flexibility. So, anyhow, that's my opinion on it. AC2GS, WB2KWC.
Okay, very good, Ken. Thank you. So, you added some things. So it's less power, so it's better with the battery. So, all those things are factors. But, David, did we answer your question, or did we create any additional questions you'd like to ask?
Yeah. I got a refurbished Macintosh computer with i9 Intel chips in it. I don't know if it's significantly different than i5 or i7. But, I got a good deal on it, so, I was very, very happy, about that. And I think there was one other thing that I think we didn't talk about regarding these chips, and that is clock speed. How does clock speed play into this?
These days, as far as I'm aware, clock speeds are not... They haven't really been able to differentiate. Back in the old days when things were running at ridiculous things like 4 and 8 megahertz, then, doubling, tripling, quadrupling the clock rate really made in gave you a significant improvement. Nowadays, the improvement from the relatively lower cost version of the same chip to the higher speed version, and they're all intrinsically the same chip. What happens is they take them out of the foundry and they ramp up the speed, and they find the batch that, through variations in manufacture, tolerate slightly higher speeds. The trouble with raising the speed, though, is it increases the amount of power that it has to consume, which heats it up the system, or requires a more significant cooling system. You might get 10%. Has not been a big feature for at least the last 10 years. The big features have been tweaking the architecture, increasing the number of cores, and the underlying memory and such that feeds the data stream
to the multiple cores in the chip. Those are the really big factors that have increased the productivity of CPUs over the last 15 years at least.
U.S. Hill, thank you, Roy. I think I get it. You know, the old computer that I had was almost the same clock speed as this computer. The old computer was i7, the new computer, i9. You know, the peripherals, the connectionable peripherals, Thunderbolt 3, USB 3.1, and also to power the monitor, monitor retina screen requires a much better video interface. So, so that comes with the new computer, the old refurbished computer, and I think I have a much better idea about it now. Thank you.
WB2KWC.
Enjoy your new refurbished computer. i9's claim to fame, as far as I'm aware, there's a little difference in the memory architecture, but it's primarily, it's more of a server design with more multiple cores. In the old days, i7 and with additional cores. Brought it up, I believe, to 6 cores now. So if you want something that's more than 4 cores, that's a few years old, you'd have to jump from i7 to i9. That's the primary reason. Servers, Xeon processors, which are very similar to the i9, run similar architectures.
WB2KWC with a comment?
Yes, Ken, please.
Okay, as we get into the modern 7s and i9s, clock speed does not make as much of a difference as, I guess, the ability to do things in parallel. I mean, a really fast clock speed would be, you do something furiously fast, and then you do something else, and you do something else. What the modern processors are doing is instead of doing, you know, especially when it comes to taking a branch or deciding, making a decision, they do all of the paths in parallel. And then once the decision is made, then they take the set of results that correspond to the decision that was made and dump that into the real registers of the machine. So essentially, they are doing what they call predictive branching. So they're basically, to make a decision, they're doing all the possible results, and then when the decision is actually made, just taking a shortcut to loading in the results of that decision, because they've already got it pre-computed.
Thank you, Ken. Yeah, I agree. A lot of research and engineering goes into predictive branching and memory transfers and all kinds of fun stuff. The underlying problem that goes way, way back is early on, before multi-CPU processors were a big thing, they were trying to get the clock speed up, and they hit a brick wall when it comes anywhere close to 5 gigahertz. Just getting it there is murder, and getting it past there is practically impossible unless you have a cryogenic factory of some kind. So a lot of engineering brains kind of shifted gears into multi-CPUs on a chip and making those multiple CPUs more efficient and better able to thread in a single program. Good programming practice is to write programs that are multi-threaded so that they could utilize more than one core. A bad design is where it can only use one core. There's still a lot of software, unfortunately, out there that is not multi-threaded. But little by little, people figure out how to do it, and they do it. So, yeah, I agree with you. Yeah.
Well, this computer is 8 cores. 8 cores. it doesn't have a lot of memory in it, and I'm wondering, do I really need to upgrade? What would be the difference between 32 gigabits of RAM and 128 gigabits of RAM?
I would think that unless you are producing a 4K movie, that you don't need anything close to that. The amount of memory is dependent upon the software you use and the size of the files that you are moving around and massaging. It's always fastest to have all your data in memory as opposed to caching it on either a hard drive, God forbid, or a solid state drive, which is faster but not as fast as just memory, RAM and such. It depends what you're doing. If you find that the things that you're doing slow down and you can look at the page files and see that you've filled up all of your memory and you're now caching to your either hard drive or solid state drive, then you definitely would benefit from more memory. My monster has, I think, 64 gigabytes. Again, unless I was doing 8K movies and special effects and 3D rendering, I can't even begin to get why most people would need something like 128 gigabyte RAM.
Well, you know, Wesley gave me some really good information about a video editing program called DaVinci Resolve, number 16, number 17. 17 is beta release, not the full version isn't out yet. He said you can set it up so that you can click on this box, this proxy, and what it does is it figures out, your computer's ability. And let's say you want to edit 4K video, but the preview size is much smaller, just inside of a box. And what you do is you do all your edits, you do all dissolves and your effects and all, and then you render it. And when you render it, the movie file, the final movie file is being created, And I don't think you need a lot of RAM for that.
Well, I mean, I have DaVinci as well. I have the free version. They give it away for free. They also have, as you mentioned, the beta of version 17. It's limited in resolution. If memory serves me, it does everything that the actual pay model does for less than 4K resolution. If you want to render into 4K or higher, you have to pay, I guess, for their dongle. So that enables that feature. And if you're going to render 8K, either way, you're going to probably need a lot of memory. Again, I don't know of anyone. I mean, maybe Wesley has 128 gigabytes. But usually 64 gigabytes, unless you have an extraordinary need, it should be more than sufficient.
Well, this computer has 32 gigabits, and you can upgrade it. You just open up a little thing in the back of the computer, and you take out what's in there, you put in the new one. 64 gigabits might be okay.
You might be fine with it. Again, I think 64 is usually the high end unless you're doing something really sophisticated. My suggestion is, all intents purposes, get DaVinci. Like I said, it's free unless you want to use the ultra high resolution aspect, and see if it slows down your system. If you've decided that it slows your system down, then there's always the option of putting memory chips. memory usually, for an old standard, tends to go down, not up. I mean, there are fluctuations all over the place. But generally speaking, as long as you're not looking for next year's standard in memory that wouldn't be useful for your motherboard, it's not going to cost any more if you wait a little bit and see if you need it.
Thank you, Roy. Yeah, I think so far so good. I made a 4-minute movie in DaVinci at 1080p. And, you know, it's previewed great, and it's rendered great, and not to complain, you know. It works quite well, thanks to Wesley, who told me about this really great software. I didn't want to become a financial asset for Adobe, you know.
Okay, I mean, that's reasonable. It can get expensive, and certainly for the lower resolution version of DaVinci, the price is certainly right, being zero. And it is a multifaceted tool, and it doesn't look anything like freeware. It looks like highly sophisticated professional software, and anyone out there who has aspirations of being a video editor for some strange reason, check it out. It's, like I mentioned, it's free. And the only problem is figuring out how to use all the great tools in it, because there are a lot of tools in it.
Thank you, Roy. Are you ready for the second question?
Okay, sure.
A friend of mine called me. He's a doctor in a hospital. We had a conversation here, and she said, better if you have a choice. To take the shots at the moment. See, she said, because from what she could see in the hospital, that this person gives much, seemingly less side effects than the Pfizer.
Okay, you broke up throughout that. I'm trying to reconstruct. Are you saying that your friend said the Moderna has less side effects than the Pfizer?
She said that from her experience, and I'm wondering if you also had the same experience with it.
Well, yeah, I mean, I would go more from literature and general understanding than a single individual. Moderna, though, does seem to have slightly less side effects. There are people who get urticaria, they get allergic reactions for the most part is the major problem, and there seems to be a little bit less of it with Moderna. Keep in mind that both of them use principally the same process. They use messenger RNA. Moderna coats it in a lipid layer, and so that might cause, that causes some differences. It's more stable, so it requires less refrigeration, and it might have a marginally better profile for immune reaction. So theoretically, if you can get the Moderna and you have a choice between the two, I see nothing particularly wrong in going with the Moderna. If your choice, on the other hand, is getting the Pfizer next week or getting the Moderna in 6 months, then I think it's probably best to go with the Pfizer, because we're still seeing a ridiculous number of people coming down with the virus because very few have been vaccinated, and that's really what counts. And, you know, every other day, 4,000 people are reported dead from this. So I would sort of agree that if you have the option for both, you might decide on Moderna over Pfizer, but not by a lot.
KP2R1. QSL, Roy. What do you know about Johnson & Johnson, the one-shot vaccine?
Zulu?
Yes, Richard recognized. I'll pick you up in a second, Rich. The Johnson & Johnson has a great deal, I hate to call it that, the promise. You know, promise is a very vague term. And the benefit is that it's a vaccine that you only have to take once is preferred over one with boosters, because inevitably there will be people who will not take the boosters, which will lead to other problems down the road, perhaps. So a one-shot deal is probably preferable. The problem is that it has not completely cleared the efficacy and safety protocols yet, and when they do, there are rumors around that they're having problems upscaling production. So they might turn out to be just as efficacious as the Moderna and the Pfizer, but their production numbers might not be anything close to the others. So, you know, six to one, half a dozen of the other.
My friend also said that you have to take this vaccine once a year, like a flu shot. She said that the government is going to pay for it, which means that taxpayers are going to pay for it. And, you know, it's like you're not clearly through the tunnel yet.
Okay, yes, we're not through the tunnel. No, it's conjecture on her part. No one has the faintest idea how long vaccines give safety to people. So anyone who tells you for a fact we're going to need it on a yearly basis, doing crystal ball, it may turn out to be that. It may turn out to be every 5 years, every 10 years, every 15 years. It may be a one-shot deal. You know, I don't have a crystal ball like your friend. So there is no definitive evidence whatsoever, as far as I'm aware of, that demonstrates a positive, there's a high probability that this is going to be an annual vaccination. And whether or not tax money goes to it, or they use some other means, you know, strong holding insurance companies, again, I don't have a crystal ball, but, you know, best to kind of dig ourselves out of this hole before we worry about the next hole.
Yeah, I think I hope for something better, that's all. Thank you, Roy.
You're welcome. Rich, you wanted to say something?
Yes, I do. If you can hear me, can you hear me?
I can hear you. There's a lot of curious noise in your background. It's not the same kind of crashing noise that's been going through the repeater. It's more of a cyclical noise in your background.
Interesting, but if you can hear me, it doesn't need to be Q5. I just wanted to report on the noise from the Sheldon side, which I'm on, and that is that it went from when I first turned on the TechNet, it was, I would say, 90% noise, 90% of the time it would go in and out. And I just went through a period of 10% noise, 10% of the time, for, I would say, 10, 15 minutes. So that tells me it can't be the wind, because the wind doesn't act like that. It just doesn't die down for that long a time. Just my observation. Back to that.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Rich. Well, what can I tell you? To me, unfortunately, right now, it's like the weather. You can talk about it, but you can't do much about it. You know, gone are the good old days where Eric would be standing there in the repeater room, tapping on the receiver, the chassis and such, and fiddling around with the controls. And so, you know, the great guys who are the technical committee, I'm sure will figure this out as well and solve it one of these days.
On the computer side, just a quick comment. Lenovo just came out with a sort of like a handheld size of a handy talking computer that looks very interesting. It's like $150 and it's only 4K of RAM, but you can up the drive to 256K digital drive. And it just has all the right inputs and outputs. And he did a 4K video test. This was on YouTube before, which is not on YouTube, right? A 4K video test that was pretty amazing. So if anybody is looking for a handy talkie size computer, a PC, that is, take a look at Lenovo's website. I don't know the name of it or the model number. You'd be really surprised. Back to next.
Okay, thank you very much, Rich. Of course, the Consumer Electronics Show, the virtual one, just finished up. Everyone and their brother announced all kinds of fun things. Lenovo, the IBM ThinkPad, but got sold to a Chinese company, announced a laptop where you can detach the keyboard, and, you know, all kinds of fun features. So we look forward to all the fun new toys that will be streaming out of China and in the months to come. China. So thank you, Rich. JC, do you mind if we kind of hold off on your question for a little while? I would like to bring Andy for his corner. Let's accept it. Here, this Sunday's installment of Andy's Corner.
Okay, the Laser CDO. Let's see if I can do this with the static. Let me just... I'm listening to my... unfortunately, the interesting thing is the signal strength is not changing. But I gotta wait for the static to go away before I continue, so. I gotta find out what the example is. Yeah, alright, so this is, unfortunately I'm listening to the static to see if it takes me out, but if it is, it's going to be a problem. I have to hold off on this. So, welcome to Andy's Corner. I'm going to try to get through this, and to continue our discussion that we started a few weeks ago on antennas and propagation. And what I did, what I have been doing in the last segment, I've been talking about propagation on the HF band, and I'm hoping to do propagation on the UHF and VHF portion of the band. So to continue that, before we get into the discussion of the antenna fundamentals for this concern, now, let me just see, Lou, MY2H, are you listening here right now, WHCDM?
Yes, I am, MY2H.
Okay, I'm just assuming you're hearing the same static that I'm hearing, is that right?
Correct.
Okay, well, that would make sense.
All right, let's see what I can do with you to at least try to convey some of this information. So, good evening, everyone, and this is Andy's Corner, and as I said, I've been talking about the propagation of radio waves and how they propagate through space and so on, and tonight we're going to continue and talk about UHF and VHF propagation, and I see it's only 9 o'clock. This is not a big segment tonight. This is only, and I'm actually reading, you know, from a book here that which I like because it gives a basic fundamental idea. Without getting into all the mathematics that's involved, believe me, there's a lot of math because I was looking at some of the engineering books on this, and it's a head scratcher as far as math is concerned. So we got a page. A page and a half or two, so we'll see if we can get through this without too many interruptions. So let me let it, let me just unkey and I'll start. Okay, so if anyone has been following my little segment on what I've been talking about, very good. Glad to have you aboard. Other people have been just listening in for the first time. That's okay too. And that's what this corner is about—to learn a little bit of how some of this stuff works hopefully a darn technical way of conveying it. So, in the UHF and VHF ranges, the ground wave extends for such a short distance from the transmitter that it serves no useful purpose for broadcasting. Alright, again, I'm listening to myself, I hear the static from that. At the same time, the sky wave is not bent enough by the ionosphere to return to Earth. All high-angle radiation at these frequencies passes through the ionized layers, except for weak, scattered reflections. With sufficient power and sensitive receiving antennas, the scatter components provide reliable communication. In this frequency range, the wave we are concerned with really is the direct wave, or signals at these frequencies travel very nearly in a straight line. That's what they mean by direct wave. Such as the same in like a beam of light. If the angle were to travel in an absolutely straight line, the range over which the signal could be received would extend only out as far as the horizon. The signal would then go out into space, and they show a diagram here, as shown by the dotted line beyond point A. There's an illustration of which shows the it shows the curvature of the Earth, and it shows a straight line. As there's an antenna a certain distance away, and let's say it follows the curvature of the Earth, and there's a straight line going from the transmitter to out to the horizon, and then hitting the antenna, but then traveling further past that point in a straight line. So that's what this illustration is showing. Alright, it gets a little bit mathematical, but not too bad, so we're going to try to get through this. Actually, the range of transmission extends quite a way beyond the optical line of sight because the atmosphere bends the wave and causes it to follow more nearly the curvature of the Earth. This bending gives good reception, and it's showing at point B in my figure here. And as opposed to the figure that it's showing here, considerably beyond the optical line of sight. This is often referred to as the signal line of sight. And we've heard these terms before. You have line of sight communications, and that's why they call it that. So line of sight, which takes into consideration refraction by the atmosphere. The bending takes place in the lower atmosphere near the Earth's surface. It is called tropospheric bending or tropospheric propagation to distinguish it from ionospheric propagation. You've heard the term tropo communication.